Which of the following does not necessarily belong with the others? Take all the time you need. Here you go. Wall Street, ethics, and making bunches of money. No fair guessing now. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday. This one happens to be the 19th day of May. Great, as always, to have you with us. And let's stipulate as we get going here that there are many, most, actually, of the people on Wall Street who do the right thing. So stipulated. But in popular perception, anyway, the idea of ethics on Wall Street 6.5 years after Lehman Brothers continues to be, if not an oxymoron, then at least a tough sell. There's a survey out today of more than 1,200 people who work in finance. Nearly one in five of them said they, quote, must sometimes engage in unethical or illegal activity to be successful in the current financial environment. Yeah. So, Marketplace's Stan Alcorn asked what it might take to change that.
John Boatwright teaches a class called Ethics in Finance at Loyola University. And on the first day of class this year, he pulled out an earlier version of this survey from 2013 that found nearly one in four financial professionals had firsthand knowledge of wrongdoing in the workplace.
People recognize that there is a problem.
In this year's survey, those numbers are about the same. But Boatwright says the problem isn't that finance attracts bad people or bad banks.
The harder to deal with reality is that there are good people in good organizations who nevertheless get involved in very significant misconduct.
One reason may be the nature of the financial industry. Psychologist Paul Piff points to the stat that one in three said compensation could incentivize unethical or illegal behavior.
The rates are high. It's also remarkable that it's not higher.
It's not just about big bonuses rewarding big risks. He says psychological research shows just reminding people about money changes their behavior.
Just the very thought of money gets people to put their own individual interests first above the collective.
To counteract that urge in an industry all about making money, white-collar criminologist Bill Black says you need a counter-incentive, like prison for bankers who break the law.
Never talk about banks, talk about bankers if you want to look at incentive structures.
The professor of business ethics, John Boatwright, will be using the updated version of the survey in his first lesson this fall. But the message will be the same, that finance needs an ethics class. I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
The Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco has created something of a stir among economists and economy watchers with a new theory on what might be behind the flat-out lousy growth figures we had for the first quarter of this year. Their argument basically goes like this, that it was a miserable winter and government economists just aren't doing enough to take that or other what are known as seasonal factors into account when they make their calculations. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has that story.
How many times have Game of Thrones fans heard this?
Winter is coming.
Actually, winter has come and gone and left a trail of confusion in its wake. The first quarter gross domestic product, or GDP growth, came in at just 0.2%. Was it really that bad, or were the numbers just not crunched enough?
You know, of course, it's always hard to separate the wheat from the chaff.
That's Glenn Rudebush, research director at the San Francisco Fed. He says the Bureau of Economic Analysis just makes seasonal adjustments as it gathers each piece of data. Rudebush says there should be another seasonal adjustment at the end of that process. He says, think of it as making gravy.
There's a lot of things in there that maybe you don't want in your final dish. So you want to reduce it down and get the real essence of flavor.
In economics, you're trying to get rid of all that extraneous noise so you can see underlying economic trends.
Well, I think they're onto something.
Ken Kuttner is a former Fed economist who now teaches economics at Williams College.
And what the San Francisco Fed has uncovered is, well, you know, maybe there's a slightly better way to do it.
How much do these GDP numbers matter? Well, the Fed uses them to decide whether it's time to raise interest rates, but it also looks at other things, according to Chris Rupke, chief economist at MUFG Union Bank.
The most important data is the unemployment rate. You know, it's the single best indicator of labor market conditions.
But lately, the unemployment rate and GDP numbers haven't jived. The San Francisco Fed says its number-crunching formula could smooth out those differences, too. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
The Marketplace consumer safety number of the day is 33.8 million. That's denominated in airbags. It's the total number of vehicles the Japanese airbag manufacturer Takata has now issued recalls for. The company, at the urging, shall we say, of the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, made the announcement today. It covers 11 different car makers and is, to quote Transportation Secretary Anthony Fox, the most complex consumer safety recall in this country ever. On Wall Street today, a little bumpy. Not too bad, though. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Congress has just a couple of weeks to figure out what to do about the Highway Trust Fund, the device through which a good chunk of the infrastructure in this country is paid for. Let's us take the broadest definition here, all right? Airports, mass transit, highways and byways, infrastructure, basically the way we get around. And the fact of the matter is that we're stuck. The average American commuter, just as a point of interest, wastes 38 hours sitting in traffic every year. You add it all up, that is 5.5 billion hours of lost productivity in total. A fact not lost on Rosabeth Moss Cantor from the Harvard Business School. She writes about this and much else in her latest book. It's called Move, Putting America's Infrastructure Back in the Lead. Thanks for being here.
I'm delighted.
I find it deliciously ironic that you set out to write a book on leadership and you got, in your words, detoured into infrastructure, which is interesting because really there's been not a whole lot of leadership on infrastructure.
Exactly. And that's what I ended up concluding, right, that I was writing a book about leadership after all. I just sort of tripped over the topic, like we all trip on potholes and we are stuck in traffic and delayed at airports. And I began to feel that this was a really important priority that affects all of us. But there's just no sense of urgency to do anything about it.
Well, let me quote you back to yourself then, and we'll riff on that for a little while. You say the U.S. has coasted on past successes, failed to fully confront mounting problems, lacked sufficient vision about future opportunities, and in Congress held essential funding hostage to partisan battles over taxes. So now that we know what the problem is, what are we supposed to do about it?
Yeah, that's a big indictment, isn't it?
Yeah.
So we are stuck in history. That is, we justified all the other big expenditures, from the Transcontinental Railroad to the interstate highways to the space race. It was all justified on defense grounds. Now it has to be justified on economic opportunity grounds. We want the middle class back. Invest in infrastructure. I think if we can rally the public and rally leaders, state and local, who do press on Washington to say this is a critical national priority for our future. This is the only way to grow the economy. State and local get it. Mayors and governors get it. And we need their voices.
Well, explain that a little bit, because clearly at the federal level, not substantively much is happening on infrastructure. State and local, though, you do write in this book, they are doing something about it.
Yeah, federal, it's so partisan, it's hard to get anything to happen. But mayors, for example, are very pragmatic. They have to run their city, and it's all about operations and transportation. Governors often have a vision about what will build their economy. Former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick had three cornerstones: jobs, education, and infrastructure.
Infrastructure is just so not sexy, though, just as a word.
I think it's not sexy, too. But my publisher said I have to have it in the subtitle because it's the money word. They said because it's now on everybody's mind. I thought when I started talking about the fact that I was writing this book that I would say infrastructure and people would go to sleep. Instead, they want to tell me their story. Huh. I can't even get a word in edgewise because they want to talk about their traffic jam, their late flight, their pothole. People are ready to hear about this, and I think hopefully to support doing something about it.
What does the day of reckoning look like? Because in, I don't know, 30 years, there are going to be 400 million people in this country.
And we'd better get them off the roads. They can't all be on the streets in their cars at the same time. So already, think about all the new business models that are in place. Car sharing services, ride sharing services. We will be able to move around so much faster because of technology, but we do have to have cars and trucks get off the roads and make room for bicycles, pedestrians, people who want to ride the rail. We need that kind of vision because you're right, that's an awful lot of people, and we are not all going to work remotely from home, as desirable as that sounds to us in the East during snowstorms. We are not.
The book by Rosabeth Moss-Cantor is called Move. Professor Cantor, thanks very much for your time.
I enjoyed it.
One definition of economics is that it's the study of the allocation of scarce resources. If you're talking natural resources in California right now, things don't get much scarcer than water. Almonds have gotten a whole lot of attention lately as an especially water-needy crop. But while the nuts do seem to be weathering the drought just fine, this is a story wrapped up in land use, investors, and, as KQED's Sasha Coca explains from the Central Valley, cows.
Kathy Smith is rolling along in a golf cart. She's calling her 35 cows to dinner.
Come, boss!
So you're saying come, boss?
Come, boss, as in bossy, as in cows. That's how my father did it. That's how I do it. And my mother used to do it by going out and playing on her trumpet.
Smith's family has grazed cattle on this ranch in California's Central Valley since 1943. She likes to tell the story of how she heard the almond trees coming to her neighborhood before she saw them.
It's 11:30 at night. We are trying to sleep, and those tractors are ripping the land right outside our bedroom.
She woke up to find giant patches carved out of the grassy foothills above her house.
I can't tell you how upset I am to have to look over there every single day and see what's happening to those beautiful foothills. It's sickening.
Plus, we're in a drought. Hello?
That's Smith's neighbor, Gail Altieri. Altieri raises mules and horses. She says their town of Oakdale bills itself as the cowboy capital of the world.
The water's disappearing. There'll be no grazing land for the cattle. And if the cowboys don't have cattle, how can this be the cowboy capital of the world?
Smith says her well went dry 4 years ago. She and Altieri blame almond growers drilling into these foothills for water.
They're not farmers. They are investors. They're out for the almighty buck and for greed, bottom line.
It's not only ranchers complaining. Paul Wenger is a third-generation almond farmer. He's also the president of the California Farm Bureau.
We are seeing investors come from all over the world trying to get on. It's kind of like the gold rush. As a grower, I think they're making foolish investments.
So just exactly who are these almond investors? Some are banks or investment funds like TIAA CREF. And then there's Trinitas. This private equity investment firm is one of Kathy Smith's new neighbors. This Silicon Valley company is funding and running a number of almond orchards scattered around the area. Ryan Payton is one of the three principals at Trinitas. He says his company is being unfairly painted as the bad guy.
We have customers all over the world because of our sustainable, responsible farming practices.
Payton takes me through the gates of his ranch to the top of a steep hill. The peaks of Yosemite provide the backdrop for acres and acres of almond trees planted in neat rows across the rolling foothills.
We irrigate at night during off-peak hours. There's less evaporation. But we also have a technique for making sure there's no runoff, that every drop goes into the root systems.
Typically, farmers use more than 3.5 feet of water for every acre of almonds. Payton claims his farm is using about 3. He also says his company stopped planting new trees in these foothills because of the drought.
Our hydrology folks are always measuring this situation because I'm always asked this question, are you affecting your neighbors adversely? And to this point, I can honestly say we are not.
In fact, he says he hopes to wean his almond trees from groundwater entirely.
So we have a history of listening and responding in a pretty conciliatory way when there's an acute problem with the neighborhood. On the other hand, they need to respect the fact that this is an ag community and that we have the right to farm.
Peyton points out that the guys who are actually managing the orchards day to day are fourth generation farmers. They even use the local pronunciation almonds instead of almonds. And by the way, no matter what you call the nuts, there's going to be a lot of them this year. Despite the drought, the USDA predicts just a 1% dip in this year's lucrative almond crop. That's about 1.85 billion pounds. In California's Central Valley, I'm Sasha Coca for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I wasn't trying to tell a story that the backdrop was some political unrest. I was trying to tell a story about everyday kids in these places and give them a microphone to say what they wanted to say.
And the music they wanted to dance to, hip-hop, as the great equalizer coming up. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 13 points today, not quite a 10%, finished at 18,312, a new record, by the by. The Nasdaq gave back 8 points, a 10%, finished at 5070. The S&P 500 down a point, less than a 10%, ended things at 2127. On the day that we learned housing starts in the U.S. were up 20% last month from a month earlier. Check on some big home builders now. KB Home Shares built up 2.4%. NVR Inc. was up 1.75%. Corporate news from the world of retail now. Walmart said its growth has been hurt by folks paying down debt instead of buying discretionary stuff. Shares in the world's biggest retailer off 4.3%. Bonds down. The yield on the 10-year T-note up to 2.28%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Fed will release minutes from its April interest rate meeting. President Obama will travel to the U.S. Coast Guard Academy in Connecticut to deliver the commencement address. And quick, check your bank accounts. It's National Be a Millionaire Day. Just don't quit your job or anything. It's only for a day. I'm Daisy Palacios.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. All right, it's all over, but the shout, and David Letterman wraps things up tomorrow night. After 22 years doing late night on CBS and more than three decades on the air as a host, Letterman himself is stepping out of the spotlight, as you know. Up in the air, however, is the fate of his production company, Worldwide Pants. Marketplace's Sally Herships has that story.
Remember when NBC decided to give The Tonight Show to Jay Leno? Letterman left for CBS, and that is when things got bitter. Marisa Guthrie is TV editor for The Hollywood Reporter.
He couldn't take a lot of the bits that he created for late night at NBC because NBC owned the show.
Guthrie says one of Letterman's popular bits was a segment called Viewer Mail. But because NBC owned the rights, when Letterman got to CBS, he had to rename it CBS Mailbag. Guthrie says that's why Letterman created his own production company, so he could call the shots.
Yeah, Worldwide Pants is David Letterman.
The company has had some big hits, like Everybody Loves Raymond, but also some shows that never made it out of development. So when it comes to the future of the company...
You know, a lot of it comes down to, you know, David Letterman himself.
James Dix is a senior media analyst with Wedbush Securities. He says Letterman is the company's single most valuable asset, that and the library of the late night shows Letterman has created over the years. Joseph Kapsch is an editor with TheWrap.com.
Is there now, you know, web opportunities or web video opportunities or streaming opportunities? It's a matter of revenue stream.
Worldwide Pants says to find out its future plans, stay tuned. Any new developments will be announced after the end of The Late Show. But it seems clear that whatever happens, David Letterman will definitely be wearing the pants. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Music, it's been said, is the universal language, but there can still be some unexpected translations. Hip-hop, both the music and the culture, started in the South Bronx in New York City and has now spread to places you might not guess. Yemen and Cambodia and Uganda don't necessarily come to mind when you talk about breakdancing, b-boying, as it's sometimes called. But that is exactly where filmmaker Adam Sjoberg went to find some young dancers for his documentary. It's called Shake the Dust. Adam, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
I was trying to figure out while I was watching this film what it's about, because it's not really about the breakdancing. I mean, it is, but it's not, right?
Yeah, I started out, actually, originally when I first started working on this film, I started making a movie about kids in post-conflict areas and in the slums. It wasn't necessarily going to be about hip-hop at first. That was 7 years back.
Yeah.
And I'm a big hip-hop fan, and I came across a little YouTube video of some kids from Uganda breakdancing. And when I saw that video, I was like, this is it.
Did the kids in Uganda turn you on to the kids in Cambodia, who turned you on to the kids in Yemen and all? I mean, is that kind of the way it worked?
Kind of. I had an initial plan just based on a, you know, YouTube research, essentially, of where I wanted to go. But Yemen was a little different. That happened really close to when I started filming in Uganda. I was connected with a friend who was a journalist in Yemen at the time, right before the Arab Spring. And she said, if you don't have anything to do after you're done filming in Uganda, come to Yemen. So I went to Yemen.
And other sentences you never thought you'd hear.
Yeah, exactly. And that ended up really being a life-changing experience. Filming there, it was arguably the most unlikely place to find hip-hop.
That's the one. That's the location that really got me. I mean, I know Uganda and those kids were the ones that got you into this, but the shots from Yemen and the background, and you know, they go into the inner city at one point, and they're doing this thing in front of, you know, the Yemen police and all these old Arab guys sitting there going, what are you doing?
Yeah.
People who are in there, like, they're really traditional people, never heard of hip-hop, never heard of breakdancing, so we're not sure how they're going to react.
Yemen is visually my favorite part of the film as well, and I think it represents a lot of what I was trying to convey in making this movie. I started filming there right before the Arab Spring broke out. But it's interesting to me because I didn't seek an issue-driven film. I wasn't trying to tell a story that the backdrop was some political unrest. I was trying to tell a story about everyday kids in these places and give them a microphone to say what they wanted to say.
These kids love music. They love being part of something different, to let people know where they came from or what they did. It's stronger than just telling people.
There are a couple of themes that run through all the locations in this film. One is they're all kids. They're all real young. Mm-hmm. But they're also all real poor. I mean, poverty is the undercurrent here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's interesting because hip-hop as a genre, as a culture, I found often really connected with people in these poor communities, and not even necessarily in urban communities, but really all over the globe, and even in some very remote rural areas that I went to. Hip-hop connected to these people because I think it gave them, especially breakdancing, a feeling that they could transcend their circumstances, that they had a language and a language to talk about what they had been through. But also with breakdancing, you have your crew, and that becomes sort of your family. And I think that that's another interesting thing for a lot of these kids who lost their parents at very young ages. Hip-hop became almost a religion to them.
And they are aware of the roots. I mean, they talk about it coming out of the Bronx, and they talk about these lyrics of, you know, I don't have what you have, but I can do what you can do, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah, there's a strong tradition that, you know, a lot of people outside of hip-hop culture don't realize that there's a rich history that is, there's an attempt at least to try and pass that down. That is honestly one of the big reasons that Nas got involved in this project.
Yeah, Nasir Jones,
Nas is one of the most legendary hip-hop artists of all time. His album Illmatic is considered by a lot of people to be the greatest hip-hop album of all time. He got on board a couple years into this project because we were able to get a trailer in front of him, and he saw that we were trying to tell a side of this history, to continue telling the oral traditional history of this genre, which is unfolding before our eyes. And you know, that is what was really exciting for me, was to see around the globe a young culture continue to develop and grow.
What happens to these folks if they don't make it? Because what's waiting for them outside the cipher, outside that circle, is, well, it's tough.
It's tremendously tough. For the kids that grew up in Yemen, some of them were privileged enough to be able to get out. But if anyone's watching the news now, Yemen's falling apart. in Uganda, it's anyone's. Anyone can tell. Because of dance, many of these break dancers and dancers from the community in Uganda have gone on to do world tours, to become choreographers that are choreographing in Europe. So it goes both ways. I've seen some of the break dancers fall into drugs and worse. So we can only hope.
It's a film called Shake the Dust by Adam Sjoberg. Adam, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today, in which this whole, millennials, gotta cater and market to the millennials thing pretty much jumps the shark. Bloomberg reports today, hey, you kids, get off my lawn. Bloomberg reports today that Tic Tac is coming out with a new product, varieties that change flavor as you suck on them. The company has apparently spent 18 months, yes, 18 months studying Tic Tacs to make sure, and this is a quote from the marketing director, that Tic Tacs are appealing to younger consumers. There are, the company says, and Bloomberg reports, three reasons people buy Tic Tacs: to freshen their breath, fine, to have a, quote, sweet, fruity moment, fine, but also, the company says, for emotional rescue, which I don't think that's fine. What about plain Tic Tacs? White ones? Green ones, maybe? Orange ones, if you have to? The Dow up 13 points today, not quite a 10%. The NASDAQ gave back 8 points, a 10%. The S&P 500 down 8 points, less than a 10%. Caitlin Esch and Vanessa Smith are the producers on our desks. Digital producers are Raghu Manavalan and Tony Wagner. The senior digital producer is Nishat Kurwa. I'm Kai Rizdal, and oh yeah, this is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.